talk Blade Runner 2049 on Screenfish Radio, I knew I needed a ringer. Face-to-face as David Peck was that man. But he didn't come alone. Michael LaFleur wanted in too. A lover of film, Michael couldn't help himself and needed the chance to speak. I knew the lingo. Every good host does. But I wasn't going to make it easy for them. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Welcome to the podcast. We are so excited this week to have returning guest and fellow podcaster David Peck back on the show. Welcome, David.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Steve.
Well, I'm glad to have you back. And David has brought with him Michael LaFleur. Michael's a lover of film, and we're so glad to have you here with us this week as well, Michael.
Great to be along for the ride, Steve. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Steve, can I do have a favor to ask. I would really prefer, instead of being referred to as David for the interview today, would you mind referring to me as KD6-3.7? Is that okay with you?
If you're going to do that, you're just going to have to call me the creator.
I might be okay with that. I mean, maybe as the conversation progresses, but I'm totally kidding. But anyway, go.
Just as long as you don't do to David what happens to replicants that don't quite measure up.
Well, this week we are talking about Blade Runner 2049, the unnecessary sequel to Ridley Scott's classic original film from 1982, I believe, starring Harrison Ford. This film takes place in, of course, the year 2049 and follows Ryan Gosling's Agent K, who is a Blade Runner that is also a replicant, seeking old model replicants and retiring them, if you will. Blade Runner 2049 is directed by Denis Villeneuve, and stars, as I mentioned, Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford. And just a reminder as we get into the podcast that this particular conversation will be filled with spoilers. If you haven't seen the film and that's something that is important to you, I would advise you to pause the podcast here and wait until you've seen the film to talk about it. However, for us to get into what the film is all about, we want to be able to have no restrictions on our conversation. So, guys, maybe before we actually talk about 2049, you can tell me, what do you think of the original Blade Runner, and what does that mean to you today? Why is it still so important?
Yeah, for me, Blade Runner, I think Blade Runner for me represents works on a variety of levels. I mean, I was pretty young when the film came out. I had up until this point sort of experienced a pretty kind of almost moralistic understanding of what film was all about from a narrative perspective. And so I'd watch things like Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Mary Poppins and Son of Flubber, and introduced, of course, to Star Wars at a pretty young age. So that sort of prepared me in a way, I suppose, for Blade Runner as not a next logical step necessarily, but a step nevertheless. And so I actually snuck out of a theater in Toronto at a theater that's no longer there. And I think at the time back in, was it 82, Steve? I think it was 1982. I think it was a restricted film. And so this was one of the first, if not the first restricted films that I ever saw. So there was this little bit of this sense of, I'm misbehaving to go and see this. And I went in with a friend, and to say that my mind was blown is an understatement. And I remember reading, I've studied philosophy for many years, and there's certain thinkers, there's certain writers that, that resonate with you, that click with you on a certain level. And I remember reading in particular Heidegger, Being in Time, and reading the first few pages of this book. I can feel it. I can smell it. I don't really even remember what I read. I couldn't explain to you what I read, but I remember the experience itself. And it's the same for me with Blade Runner. And I think Blade Runner is a film to be, it's to be enjoyed, it's to be experienced and so on. But I really think it was about where I was at the time and what it sort of introduced, to me, and it was, which was this world of possibility. Wow, I didn't know you could do that with movies. I didn't know that you could do that with story. How did they draw me in? And this was before I knew who Ridley Scott was, or you know, Philip K. Dick, or anything along those lines. So I think it was about the experience for me. It wasn't so much, I suppose, about the film itself. I've come to love the film on for other reasons, you know, from a story perspective and performances and what it means metaphorically and all those kinds of things. But I think in and of itself, it was the right place at the right time for me. Turn my world upside down from a filmic perspective. That's for sure.
Well, I can see that based on the fact that Son of Flubber helped prepare you for Blade Runner, as you mentioned before.
Yeah, can we actually the next time we get online, can we do Son of Flubber? Is that
sure? Why not?
And then just bookend it with Mary Poppins and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and I'll be good.
Oh, I love Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Oh man, I love that film. I am still amazed that you're using that compared to Blade Runner, but that's fine. That's
right. No comparative analysis here at all.
Both are just dystopian futures. I mean, that's right.
I think for me, Steve, it was my love for that film came a little later. Unfortunately, I was still infected with a rather unhelpful dualistic frame in my experience. So I thought, you know, that just, you know, couldn't possibly have any redemptive good in it. So it wasn't until some years later that I kind of came back to and discovered how film is just impregnated with, in my perspective, just the fingerprints of God. So many redemptive themes. What's true is true, and it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, coming from a so-called Christian source or from the world of art and film. And it was just a revelation to me of somebody was asking profound questions about what it means to be human, and that whole exploration. And you are drawn into this conversation, and out of it comes such important matters for us to wrestle with, and it has huge implications. So I think, you know, that's bringing a mind that began to kind of dial into those things about 20 years ago or so. And I certainly have enjoyed it. And then watching it again just recently before I went to see the recent film, I was overwhelmed with the exceptional set design and the cinematography and just the brilliance pre-CGI that was brought to that storytelling. I am a great believer in visual narratives. I'm a huge Terrence Malick fan, so I love that which is not explicit, but that which is just beautifully implicit through the visual. And I think Blade Runner had the original film had such a powerful amount of that, and it left it, especially if you watched the director's cut without the narration over top of it. You have, I think, just a beautiful chance for that to raise a lot of questions and create space for conversation and reflection.
One of my favorite moments in the new film in 2049 is near the end when, you know, Gosling and Harrison Ford are having a drink, and they're sitting at the bar, and he looks at him and he says, "I want to ask you some questions." And I've seen the film twice now, and it resonated with me, you know, sent shivers up my spine both times, because really for me, I think, just to echo, you know, what Michael's saying, at a very young age, it really started to raise some really important questions for me about, you know, well, first of all, how do you even do that with film? Deeply philosophical, right?
Yeah.
Deeply relational. What does it mean to be human and so on? And here I am at this young age going, I don't even know what to do with this, you know? And yet it planted some seeds with me that have resonated for many, many, many years. And too, just the visual beauty, the cinematography, it just, the threads are continuous.
Well, I mean, there's no question. I mean, there's so much conversation you can have in that film, but none of you guys have mentioned Wesley Snipes at all in the film. We're talking about Blade, aren't we?
Oh, that's hilarious.
It's a whole other kind of dystopia. and I think it mostly has to do with somebody's acting career, actually.
In all seriousness, you know, my experience with Blade Runner was later. It was much later. I wasn't interested in it growing up. It just seemed so, it sort of hadn't hit the mark with me yet. But when I was in university, I read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And I remember, I thought, okay, now is the time. I got to go back. And it was around the time of university that I really discovered my love of all things film. And not just that I loved watching films, but that sort of this idea of listening to them. And Michael, everything you said there resonates with me. I mean, both you guys, but Michael, you're talking about, you know, asking the questions that sort of, whether or not truth is coming from scripture or the church or whether it's coming from a film, the questions that need to be asked are being asked. And a lot of times the artists are the ones who are daring to ask them. But Blade Runner, I mean, you look at it now, and again, watching it just before going to see 2049, it is an incredible set piece and conversations about what it means to be alive. And at the same time, you're right, David, when you talk about the visual, I think it was David, it might've been Michael that mentioned the visuals before CGI. Like, they're just stunning. Like, it is absolutely unreal to see this film that almost feels like a cross between Star Wars and Chinatown.
Mm.
It's the ultimate in sci-fi film noir since, maybe ever. Let's talk about 2049. 2049, of course, it really is one of those movies that when it first was announced, people rolled their eyes or were nervous because Blade Runner has a huge legacy. Maybe that's a better way to describe it, because it has a bigger legacy than it does a following. So how did you actually feel about 2049? Did it meet your expectations, or did it somehow fall short?
Yeah, no, it didn't. I mean, it obviously expectations were high, and I did everything in my power not to read any reviews other than the few that Michael sent to me. And I did, you know, how can you not see things online from time to time, I suppose. But I did my best to go in kind of fresh and clean, and I've seen the film many times over the years and saw it, you know, within the few weeks before it opened, and saw it opening night in IMAX and so on. So experientially, I took no notes, went to see it a second time and took notes on the second viewing. But however, having said that, I think after the second viewing, I think I have even more of an appreciation for it than the first time around. But visually, I mean, I was just, it knocked my socks off. I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous. You could pretty much stop the film anywhere in the, 2 hours and 44 minutes and have a framed image that you could put on the wall. I mean, it's that stunning. It's just the cinematography, the sets, isn't it the same cinematographer, Deakins, the guy who did the original as well? So, I mean, and I just love the way Denis Villeneuve just sort of, I don't know, speaking of threads, just linked the two worlds together so beautifully, and yet took us beyond 2019 and Blade Runner itself. So for me, It met them on the first showing and then exceeded them on the second viewing. And I actually, to be honest with you, can't wait to go and see it again, because and I think Michael would probably say the same, but I saw more, way more, as often is the case the second time around.
Oh, absolutely. That's totally my experience. It was almost like I was so overwhelmed by the visual, just immersed in this experience, not knowing where it was going. I found it entirely fresh and new. I don't even think a sequel, it just shouldn't even be used, that term, to describe it, because it had such a fresh, both an original with appropriate continuity and points of connection. And when you see it a second time, you certainly pick up more of those nuances. But I think Denny just did a masterful job in bringing such a deeper and richer kind of treatment of similar questions that were raised in the first film, and now just continuing to explore how do you know what's real, and the place of memory and the place of you know, a personal experience. He just raises so many essential and vital existential questions. It's a philosopher's you know, paradise. It's just a place you can, a playground you can explore, and I can't wait to get back to see it. Very similar to David, I was so struck by the visual impact of it, and just went on the ride, took no notes, went in the second time, tried to be more sort of mindful, and got so much of it. I can't wait to see it a third time, and probably another time after that. It's just that rich. It keeps it's multi-layered, and it just keeps delivering.
Yeah, it's an incredible film, David. Well, first of all, Deakins was not the cinematographer in the original film. That was Jordan Cronenweth. I'm looking at it right now.
Okay.
Deakins has absolutely remarkable in this. You guys absolutely hit it on the head. David, you'll be proud of me. I saw it in IMAX. So
okay, good. So our friendship, we can continue a friendship.
We can continue it on. I know how bitter you were about the Dunkirk issue. I was really nervous, so I made sure I saw it in IMAX. But
right, Deakins is Villeneuve's cinematographer primarily, right? The guy that he works with the most.
Villeneuve.
Can't talk about Blade Runner without talking about Arrival. I mean, Denny can be trusted with extraordinary storylines and the beautiful sort of storytelling within the sci-fi genre, but such a smart thinking, reflective sci-fi genre that doesn't rely on wild aliens and blowing stuff up. And it's just Deakins was fantastic in that one. He's done a lot of great films. I loved him in Arrival, and he's just taken to a whole other level in the latest Blade Runner.
I really have become a huge, huge fan of his work. Even the movies of his that I've seen that I like less than others, they're all interesting and they're all complex. Whether or not I always like where he goes, everything he does is layered. He has his own sort of voice. In some ways, I actually saw this film as a follow-up to Arrival. Again, because sometimes you can pick up on continuity or continuous themes. The themes in Arrival of life and creation and how that relates to as how we interact in humanity, like that to me was a natural follow-up in some ways. The two films had some overlap in that way. Like it didn't feel out of nowhere. Deakins has not won an Oscar. I really hope this is the one that finally gets him one.
I think this film's going to get nominated for a few. I sure hope it does. It'd be a huge disappointment if it doesn't.
Well, here's the question then, guys. Why didn't it make the money they thought it would? Why don't you think? Because
it's interesting. I went to see it. Just last night, and there were. So it was a late show. There was 5, 7, 9 people who walked out of the theater at about the 2-hour mark. Wow. And I wanted to get up and follow them out and just open the door and yell out, "You're idiots." But I think that sort of speaks a little bit to why there's a group of people who it clearly didn't resonate with, to your point about, not being the usual fare. I mean, the original Blade Runner, your comment about having a legacy versus a following, I think is interesting because it does have a following, but it's not, maybe it's not a huge following in the sense that I think it's liked for different reasons, I suppose, is maybe what I'm saying, than say a Star Wars. Very, very, very different following, right? Although, there probably would be a lot of crossover there. I mean, this is a thoughtful piece of science fiction. So it's slow moving. I mean, yes. I mean, I think that's one of the strengths of it, to be honest with you. But clearly it appeals to a certain type of moviegoer, and don't want to get old fartish and go all cynical, but it's depressing to me that what was the horror film that opened the week after Blade Runner? Happy Dead Day or Happy Death Day?
Happy
or something?
Death Day, yeah.
I don't even want to get the title right, and yet it made more money than Blade Runner did, on that weekend. And I don't know. I find that pretty discouraging myself.
Yeah, and I think, David, we are inclined to appreciate film that actually requires something of you, that actually engages you and doesn't just feed you and you just drift along. It actually invites you to, like a great piece of art, you can take a quick glance at it. That's nice, but if you really have the will, it will just be this limitless, this expansive piece of beauty and glory that opens up before you. And it requires you, though, to engage. It requires you to think. It requires you to reflect. And I'm not sure that there's a lot of filmgoers that want to do that. Some people, you hear the expression, I just want to go see a flick. I just want to kind of be entertained. And there's a place for those kind of films. But this film, I think it just appeals to a different kind of person that might be reflecting, might be asking questions. And I think it will eventually get, as the original film did, more credibility and respect as time goes by. But it's just for sure it's It has just too rich, too dense for most palates, and there's just people haven't acquired a taste for that, especially with a lot of the recent filmmaking, and hopefully that could change. But I think there's enough of us out there who are crazy enough to engage in this kind of the style of film, the genre of film, and hopefully just enough to make enough money and watch what it does as the years roll by.
Well, I mentioned before we got on the line the article by Scorsese that he wrote for the Hollywood Reporter a couple of weeks ago. I think it was on the we just pulled it up, October the 10th. Martin Scorsese on Rotten Tomatoes Box Office Obsession and Why Mother Was Misjudged. But here's the opening paragraphs. He says, "Good films by real filmmakers are made to be decoded, consumed, or instantly comprehended." And I mean, I think he's right. I mean, how can you disagree with Martin Scorsese? That would be an outrage, it seems to me. There's clear, you can't go into a film like this thinking, "Oh, I'm just going to hang out and
my brain off."
Yeah, I mean, you can try, but I guess that's maybe why the movie doesn't work. Maybe why the storyline doesn't work, because there are long takes. It does move slowly. The music itself is it's to Scorsese's point. I think what he's trying to say is they're meant to be experienced.
Mm.
You don't just go in from beginning, middle, end, done. It's working on different levels.
Well, and I think it's worth mentioning too, and maybe this is, I may be overstating it here, but when it was originally released, Blade Runner was not well received. It was not well received by the general public. It didn't do well financially. Really, it was rediscovered about 10 years later, through home video release in about the early 90s, that Blade Runner really, people went back and went, wow, there were people that offered it great reviews then, but it wasn't picked up by the general public until much later. So it's one of those films that nobody was standing there with their hands clapped and saying, "Let's have another. We need more of this," which I think is one of the great challenges of it. With the trailers for it, you can almost smell the fear in the trailers, because so much of the trailers is focusing on Gosling and Ford together, and then they throw in a few explosions and running and try and make it look. It almost looks like a buddy cop movie. The way the trailer looks, it almost looks like these two guys, these are the two big stars in Hollywood. They're in it the whole time. Don't worry, Harrison Ford's back. Harrison Ford's not in it the last 45 minutes of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said earlier, Steve, in our offline conversation, that's why I rarely like to watch trailers of films I know I'm going to go see. The only time I'll watch a trailer if it's a film that I don't want to see and I just want to confirm my bias on it. But because if you go in just wide open and just go on the journey, it's extraordinary. It takes you, even if you don't understand. I can't believe how much I missed the first time. I don't just mean, small detail. I actually didn't quite get some of the extraordinary plot line that emerges, and the dialogue, just small things in the dialogue. The second time is like, I felt like I saw like a film that was, five times more impactful. Mm. And that's, I think that's just the weakness of people who approach film to kind of reduce it down to a trailer. It's so impossible to do that.
Yeah, it's a delicate balance, because the truth is the studio wants to make money off it. They invested $120 million. They knocked it out of the park. They actually made a film that I would argue somehow feels necessary. There is some aspect of the script that almost made you feel like this movie is important. So it didn't feel like a tacked-on sequel that they said maybe we can cash in on a few bucks. But in doing so, I think they alienated some, like the casual film goer, as you said. Talk about people just looking to go and just sort of kick back and relax. Mother actually did the same thing in a lot of ways, because the new Aronofsky film, we just talked about it in the last episode, the trailer sold it as Jennifer Lawrence in a home invasion movie. It is so much more maddening and bizarre and out there than that it's completely inaccessible if you sell it that way. But it's marketing. It's a challenge in marketing.
Well, and Steve, I'm sure at some point you want to jump in and just consider a couple of the many poignant scenes
sure,
of the film.
Absolutely.
And I love the economy of dialogue. I mean, that's to me one of the great strengths of guys like Villeneuve and Terrence Malick and stuff. They don't bury you with dialogue. They leave space for you to reflect, to think, to for something just to wash over you visually, and then comes words. And one of the scenes that I just remember stuck out to me, and I made some notes second time around, is the scene where they're examining the bones they found in the ossuary, and they're in kind of the, if you will, the morgue or the room back in headquarters. And Lieutenant Josh, he played by Robin Wright, sort of they discover that there's these scalpel marks in the kind of in the pelvic region of these bones. It's a female, and they think it's an emergency C-section. And so the question she asks is, so where's the kid? Hmm. And then there's this long pause, and she says, "That's not possible."
Hmm.
Spoiler alert here, if you're still listening. She was a replicant.
Yeah.
Pregnant. And then she says this incredible line: "The world is built on a wall that separates kind."
Hmm.
"Tell either side there's no wall, you've bought a war or a slaughter." And you think about our culture today, and just, you know, there's an increasing, you know, tendency toward division and toward, a polarization of left and right and everything. There's no ability to actually see that what differentiates us from the other is not what we think. In fact, there's far more that we have in common. And as you guys well know from seeing the film, this movie just plays around with that theme. And is somebody a replicant or are they not? Is it on the qualities that truly make one human, or that we would commend as being kind of ideal from a humanity's point of view? I think there's some amazing lines, some places that this comes through. And I, again, that's just why I'm thrilled with the film, and there's so much to draw out of it.
There's so many great scenes. There's so many great one-liners. There's or conversations and metaphors and the symbol and so on. What I want to know, question to you guys and to your listeners, I suppose, Steve, is this film about relationships? Is it about being authentic? Is it about being human? Is it a political film? Is it an environmental film? I mean, you know, sometimes I interview a lot of documentarians, and for me, you the film is supposed to be about X, and then you watch it and it's about 26 other things. And I'm kind of exaggerating, but not really. You know, there's all these layers. And for me, Blade Runner and 2049 and most great films touch on a lot of different subjects, but wondering what you guys think. Where did you guys land with that? I mean, it's such an environmental film, really, it seems to me, but way more than that.
Right, David, can I just say yes? It's like to all your
exactly. Yeah,
like, yes.
Yeah.
Because seriously, it is so many of those things. It's working on so many levels. You jump in, Steve.
Well, no, I was actually going to say exactly the same thing. When you talk about what the film is doing, the effectiveness of it is that, yes, it's all of those things. In a lot of ways, it sounds like what you hear about going on in the U.S., you know, talking about the division and the dividing lines and the walls, walls that separate kind. You know, you talk about Lieutenant Joshi says, Joy is actually my favorite character in the film. I think she's just absolutely outstanding. His digital assistant, if you will.
His hologram.
Yeah, his hologram. His hologram. She's so much more than that, though.
Yeah, exactly. Guys, don't you guys love the fact that a replicant has a digital girlfriend? I mean, how bizarre is that?
Yeah,
I mean, at least have a replicant as a girlfriend, for heaven's sake.
But after that scene reminiscent of Ghost, where, you know, the disembodied Swayze gets a chance to be inside a physical person, and there's the romantic encounter between Kay and Joy, but Joy's now, you know, inside the body, the physical representation of an actual person, and they're having that intimate encounter. Don't you just love it? She says, "I've been inside you. Don't get too excited, girl. I've been inside you. There's not much there, not much going on."
She was totally made up to look like Pris from Blade Runner. Yes,
that's actually true.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Okay. I would just, there were lots of little homages throughout, and I don't know if I'd have to see it again, but did we hear the Vangelis music just at the end of the film? Well, there seemed to be like echoes at different points in the film of the soundtrack from the, you know, from Blade Runner, but near the end, you know, just before, Gosling's character, you know, sort of sits down on the steps when the gorgeous scene, by the way, we start to hear a little bit of Vangelis.
Hans Zimmer, right? Yeah. David, come on.
Oh, I know. The soundtrack's unbelievable. It's crazy. It's crazy. Totally crazy.
Yeah, he usually has his guy that he works with. I forget what his name is. Like Jonas Johansson or something.
And they collaborated. He collaborated with Zimmer as well. So it was a joint production on the track.
Well, Johansson actually left the project because one of the things they wanted it to do, they wanted it to feel more like, they went with Zimmer because they wanted it to feel more like Vangelis's original soundtrack. They said it had to sound like it. So they actually were seeking to make it as close to it as possible.
But David, connections between the first film and the second film, the eye, I mean, the opening shot is this massive eye on the screen. How huge was that? You know, the eye was the gateway in to try to sort of somehow figure out who was a replicant and who wasn't, right, in the original film. I mean, did you see the number of times that sight, that light, and the fact that Wallace is blind? Did anyone pick that up? Here's this guy who's blind, and yet he's gonna make some assessment of the latest version of a replicant. Is this one, you know, what he's looking for? And he needs an implant to actually see. I mean, the biblical motifs in this were just, you know, so many in the film that, as I watched it the second time, especially.
Yeah, no, eyes throughout in both of the films for sure. And what I forget his name. His last name was Morton. The guy who
Sapper Morton.
Yeah, that's right. Who Kay takes out? You know, he wears glasses.
Why
is a replicant wearing glasses? Yeah. Like I love those little bits of business. And did anybody catch too when Deckard says, when they reintroduce him basically to Rachel, seems like he's maybe going to cross over, like he's going to step into this even deeper illusion. I mean, it's just bizarre. It's illusion upon illusion, right? Replicant upon replicant. It's bizarre.
Her eyes were green.
Her eyes were green. They were actually brown. Her eyes were actually brown, and yet he takes it even a step further. It's wonderful stuff. Wonderful stuff. I love the fact that, you know, the replicants in 2049, I mean, clearly in Blade Runner, they're struggling. They want to be humans. Roy says, I want more life, you know, before he basically takes, you know, Terrell out in the first film. And yet in this film, They're very difficult as the replicants in the film itself say, you know, they allude to this fact that they are, you know, more human than human, right? They're so lifelike in every possible way. But right at the beginning, did you guys catch it when Gosling they've been in the fight, they've been punching each other out, and he says to him, please don't get up.
Yeah.
If he gets up, he knows he's going to have to kill him. And I just thought it was just such a beautiful touch in the writing, but also in the way Gosling presented it. It's just marvelous stuff. Because for me, you know, Steve, to your earlier comment, you know, what is real and what is authenticity? What is transparency? What does it mean to be loved? What does it mean to be wanted? Yeah, there's just so many profound, marvelous questions to ask after a film like this. And I think this is where I so love the piece that Scorsese wrote, because, you know, the whole idea is that films are, you know, you experience them and you let them grow. Yeah. You let them resonate. And that's a great piece of art, it seems to me.
Well, and Sapper Morton's word line sentence that just, you've never seen a miracle.
That's yes. Right. You've never seen a miracle.
Imagine that. I mean, it just, and I don't know if anyone else picked up. I mean, there's just so many of those kind of things that are there in the film, and it's almost limitless what you can draw out of it if you've got eyes to see. Don't you love how he is? They've built into this latest generation this compliance, this sort of willingness to obey. They never back and thinking, wow, talk about issues, you know, raising issues of free will and choice, and which of course were in the first film. And it's like they're asking the most fundamental questions of what it means to be human. And yet here you see them, you know, being able to lie about, you know, having destroyed everything. And he's not going to get rid of the wooden horse. He's not going to get rid of that one thing that's linked him. And he doesn't trust the memory initially, but all of a sudden he begins to think that maybe he's the one. I mean, there's so many ways in which they've played around with that fine line of what defines and divides between something which is real and human and something which is, you know, artificial and you know, implanted.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about Kay as well that I found in the film is that there's almost an allusion to Pinocchio, because he desperately wants to be real, but he's desperately terrified to be.
Well, there's literally a line that says that when he's talking to the scientist, the Dr. Anna Stalene, inside, you know, her bubble. That's exactly what she says. She has a Pinocchio line that's literally jumped right out of the film. I mean, that's Pinocchio line, right? Yeah. You probably caught the same line, Steve.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting because if you look at the things in the film that, you know, he's standing with the prostitutes. Now we find out later she's a replicant, but she says, "You don't like real girls." And that seems to be the unappealing factor to him. When he's at Sapper Morton's house, Sapper offers him some, was it real mushrooms or something like that? I forget what it is that he's making.
Garlic. He's got garlic.
Garlic. Yeah. That's it. And he's sort of not, you know, I don't want to touch that. Actually, and at one point, Joy says to him something about, I think she says, "I love you." And he goes, "Why did you say that? You said that because you're programmed to say it." But at the same time, when he finds out that he's not the child, he's disappointed. He's crushed because he desperately feels like he's missing something. That was the thing I loved about the idea of the miracle, because when I was, you know, this idea of the film, life feels like something that's just out of reach. Like, you know, in the first film, when it's wrestling with this idea of life, it does so in a different way. I mean, there's this relationship between creator and creation. But this one, there's something so unique about the fact that life seems to have, well, I was going to say a life of its own, but that's redundant. But there's something powerful that is beyond the replicants. You know, they are almost human, but they're not human.
And the journey that Kay goes on. I mean, when he finally meets up toward the end of the film with the leader of the underground, with the woman who's sort of one of the main leaders in the underground. I think her name is Freyja. Her great line is, "Dying for the right cause. It's the most human thing we can do." And here's Decker, you know, willing to put his life, willing to literally lay down his life. Here's Kay willing to lay down his life for Decker and kind of go against the grain of you know, what will preserve the order out there. It's fantastic the journey that that Villeneuve takes us on in the story, the arc of the narrative. It's just fantastic. It's to me, it's filled with hope. It's filled with possibilities. This isn't all fate. We aren't all locked into whatever our pre-programmed sense of identity is. There is the possibility of growth, of change, of becoming, not just sort of being locked into what we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With that in mind, I mean, what do you think about the role of Wallace? Wallace is definitely this film's creator, you know, with the same role that his name escapes me, but in the original film, the designer of the replicants, we have a new designer of the replicants.
Tyrell,
of course, Tyrell. What do you think about the role of the creator in this particular film?
Yeah, I think, you know, just sort of gonna let me explore this a little bit here with you guys. But I think it's, for him, it's about power, and I don't think it has anything to do with creation or science or progress or wonder, or, you know, as he talks about his angels. I think it's all about greed and power, it seems to me anyway, you know. And I think he really, I mean, he's a pretty difficult, creepy kind of a character guy to get to know. Does anyone really know him? And I would imagine probably not. The people closest to him are replicants, for crying out loud. So that's, I think, pretty interesting. But yeah, so what is this really all about for him? Is it about the money? I don't think so. But perhaps. But yeah, power, privilege, and position. You know, and I thought his, like I said, I thought his true colors sort of started to really show up near the end with Deckard, and you don't know what pain is. You actually think for a moment that maybe he's reintroducing Rachel into Deckard's life because he kind of cares in a way. Like I almost bought that for a second or two, and yet no, this is. I was going to say complicated, but that's almost giving him too much value, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think one of the things I loved in that scene, David, is his. He so desperately wants to be able to do the thing that Decker has been able to do, that Decker and Rachel were able to do, and yes. He can't do it. He's not able to actually accomplish that, and all that power, all that ability to, you know, to so-called create. And Decker's great line, he says, "You don't have children, do you?" And, you know, retorts back, "I have millions." Well, no, you don't. You actually don't have millions.
Yeah.
You've never actually known what it's like to create something that's free, something that's, you know, that's given permission to be something other than what you've programmed it to be. The guy who's the richest man in the world is Deckard, not Wallace, even though Wallace has all the power and all the autonomy to do what he wants to do with them. These beings.
This year in film, there's actually been several creators. Alien Covenant, David's role, but it was a distant creator. Guardians of the Galaxy, for crying out loud. The new Guardians of the Galaxy film brought in, why can't I think of his name?
Kurt Russell.
Kurt Russell, thank you. Yes, Kurt Russell, to take on a creator role, but he's like reckless. But in this film, I would almost argue he's restless. I think you hit it on the head when you talk about power and position, David, because I think for him, he has to crack the code. He has to put himself in a godlike position because he has to prove that he can. He understands, you know, he talks about his creations as angels, sure, which is interesting too because, you know, when you talk about angels, scripture talks about angels as being less than creation, less than human. So they're still viewed by God as somehow less than his actual creation. But this is a creator who doesn't know how to create.
Right.
He can build robots, but he can't take that next step for life. And even sex in this film. I mean, there was nudity in the first film. There's nudity in this film. But sex sort of is used as a reminder of the most human and divine act of miraculous creation, you know? That's the thing. Sapper says, "You've never witnessed a miracle," because this shouldn't happen. This shouldn't happen. There is something greater than Wallace, and it drives him crazy.
Well, I think, you know, your comment about there's something greater, I think there's an undertone throughout the whole film that there's something else going on. There's way more going on here than meets the eye. And sure. We've got so much going on that is meeting the eye, but let's go below the surface. And I think it's really interesting that, you know, the where he sees the flower, the dead, the tree that's held up by guy wire, which is so fascinating and just astonishing. The scenes there, the way that's all laid out, just so crisp, so beautiful, will resonate with me. Images that will resonate with me for years to come. But he gets into his car and sees the flower and comes back to it again later. And of course the date and 6/10/21 and all of that. But I think the flower for me, we don't really come back to that in a huge way, but for me, it's almost like this little sliver of hope, this place that has been leveled on pretty much every level, societal, political, sociological, environmental, relational, you know, all the humans have basically left this. Well, most of the humans have left. The ones that have any kind of wealth, they're off world now, right? So there's a whole other subtext, by the way, class division and Michael, your comment about slave labor and all of that. But I love the little flower. There's something else going on here. Not really sure what, but we're going to find out.
Well, there's a couple of things that Wallace, you know, there's so many things about Wallace's character. I think Leto just, he does such a great job with such a small amount of screen time. But I don't know if anyone else had this, but it was King Herod profoundly threatened by this thing. And it's Lieutenant Joshi, Robin Wright's character, who just has, to me, the line of the film. I don't know if we can say the quoted verbatim here on the film, but after Kay's been sharing what he's found out, Coco gets killed, the word gets out. She says, so he's telling her what else he's found. He's burned everything. And then she said she has this great line after she sees the 610-21 at the base of the tree in the picture that Kay's got. And she says this: "Am I the only one who can see the effing sunrise here? This breaks the world, Kay." Mm. David, it's like you and I have talked so often. The incarnation changes everything. Mm. I think it's if we actually realize what happened when the eternal God becomes one of us, it changes everything. It breaks the whole system and structure of a fallen world. It's the beginning of the great reversal, to use C.S. Lewis's quote. It's like something profound's happened. And here's Wallace, you know, he's like King Herod, you know, just in his madness trying to snuff out, you know, or trying to take this, you know, this king, this gift for himself, and he's got no part of it. He's completely of a different order, different kind, and he doesn't know how to take the risk that the Father, Son, and Spirit did in creating beings that were truly free, that actually could resist and reject and rebel, because that's the only way to create the possibility of real love. There is no love without the possibility of saying no, of pushing away, of turning away. And that's what I love about, you know, the characters in the film, that they draw us into that kind of a dialectic.
Oh, it's so true. And you look at it too, this film really, of course, takes the perspective of the replicants, and what is the incarnate, or what is the baby symbolize, but as a new beginning, a new opportunity, freedom for the replicants, because it can't be controlled anymore. I can't believe that one of the films I actually compared it to a lot thematically was Jurassic Park, which seems like I'm doing it a disservice, but the truth is, you know, life finds a way in that one there. But you look at the incarnation, and here you have this child who in his creation, or in her creation, I should say, in her creation in this particular film, all of a sudden establishes a new opportunity for life for the replicants. And that's powerful imagery.
Anyone else see shades of Children of Men in this film?
Oh, for sure.
Nice, David.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, just even well, thematically, but also stylistically, definitely, I would say some similarities there. Sure, you made fun of Son of Flubber, and you ring in Jurassic Park.
I it's true. I realized as the words were leaving my mouth, I died a little bit inside.
What's her name again, Joshi? She's got Robin Wright. She's got some great lines in the film. When she goes to see him at his apartment, and they're having a drink together, the line, and for me, it's, you know, and Steve, you had asked, I think, the question, or you made a comment about just real, and again, Matrix, right?
Yeah.
The simulacra, you know, no one can be told what the Matrix, you know, you got to learn it for yourself. But she says, we're all just looking out for something that's real. Mm. And, you know, in another context, delivered by somebody else, it could have been uber corny. But in for me, it's just like, yes, that is exactly what this film really is all about. We're looking for real relationship. We're looking for real love. We're looking for real connection. Isn't this really what it's all about? And that's why, for me, the irony of the replicant who's got a digital girlfriend who seems to really want real love.
Yeah.
It's just wonderful stuff. Well, oh, and how about his sister, essentially? How about that?
Yeah.
You know, Deckard and Rachel's daughter. What's her line about? She's got a compromised immune system, which we could talk about, but for her, freedom, she can have freedom as long as it's behind glass.
Yeah.
I love that kind of stuff. That kind of writing.
But did you see how she was trying? She had created such real memories for Kay to experience, and that's why he was, you know, so understandably fooled by the reality of them. And it's the vicarious, again, there's all these scenes of vicarious humanity. David, in her character, right, she's allowing others to kind of live inside, you know, the world that she creates, even though in the film she's not able to, you know, kind of enter out into so-called the real world. But the hand coming out, the snowflakes falling on the hand, how many times do you see that in the film? And Kay's looking up and he's feeling that, and then in that closing scene in the film, it's happening inside the bubble, inside her sort of holographic world.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's great too, that moment where she says to him, it's illegal to use real memories, when he has that moment. And really, I mean, our humanity is connected to our memory, and without our memory, we are without a doubt human still, but we're different people. If we can't recollect, if we can't go back, if we can't connect those dots in some way, you know, that whole, you know, Kierkegaard's notion of, again, you know, moving forward and understand by looking backward. If you don't have anything to look backward on, it's kind of challenging to know who and why and where, you know. And but I love the line to Kay, it's illegal to use real memories. And she says it while she's crying, kind of admitting to us that these are, in fact, you know, real memories. It's just,
it's gorgeous. It's, someone lived this. Yeah, it happened. And then Kay has this, you know, that just this piercing sort of realization. I know what's real. I know what's real. Damn it. God damn it. He says, and that's just, you know, that was such a fantastic scene.
Mm. Yeah. So good. Yeah. For a piece of sci-fi, it's a deeply moving film if you're willing to stick with it. I wonder, Steve, to your comment, if the film had been, I don't know, an hour 45, or if it had come in under 2 hours, would it have been doing, you know, better at the box office? Would people have stayed with it a little longer? I was actually kind of offended by the walkouts last night, to be honest with you. But yeah, what are you going to do, right?
It was the late movie.
It was the late show later,
right?
So. Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
in all seriousness, it might have done better at the box office, but I don't think it would have been a better film. I think it did. When they started filming this, they said, "We are going to do this, and we're going to do it right." I know that they are in it to make money, and they need to make their money back. But the truth is, it's going to ease a lot of the pain if come awards season, we see the name Blade Runner 2049 pop up in a few places other than visual effects.
So I know you're probably going to be wrapping up here soon, Steve.
Yeah,
I don't
exactly
know where your intentions are, but I could go on for another couple hours, as I'm sure your listeners could.
I know,
not.
I was thinking that. But, I'm like, oh.
But what's with the beehives?
Isn't that fantastic?
It's fantastic. And that whole sequence of Las Vegas and the sets, the cinematography, it's absolutely stunning. Just stunning. But these are real bees, are they not?
I think they are. That's how I read it when I saw it the second time.
They have to be. They pretty much have to be real bees. Yeah. Anyway, I'm still kind of reflecting on the whole bee thing, honey thing.
I'm mad that you asked that question because I don't know the answer, and by asking it infers that I have to answer it. So
right.
You got there first. It's like, I had no idea what the bees were.
In order to be bees, there has to be new growth, new creation. There has to be more flowers. There has to be more flowers.
There has to be hope.
Totally. It's absolutely. There's a world that's out there that's being recreated.
That's true.
There's another world coming. There's another world. I could see, you know, on a better, right, you know, that great quote, David, you're the guy who quotes. It's the hope that's there. It's Shawshank Redemption, you know.
Yeah.
It's you're seeing another world. There's another world that's possible, and the bees to me are just kind of those prophetic forerunners of speaking to that hope.
You know, thinking about Kay and this idea of hope, and even going back to what is real, I believe it was Lewis, C.S. Lewis, that actually talked about kicking and screaming into the kingdom. And that's sort of the imagery that I get from Kay, because he's so resistant to believing that he is something special or that there is something bigger than he is, but he wants to so badly, and he is drawn into it in such a powerful, powerful way that things like he's amazed by those. I can't believe we're spending so much time on the bees, but he's amazed by the bees. And actually, he even says to Deckard when he sees him, he looks at the dog, he says, "Is it real?" And he goes, "I don't know, ask him."
Yeah, that's right.
I think it's the only
he's
joke.
Also, hey, I got to get a Lewis line in here. He's also surprised by joy.
There it is, literally and figuratively.
Exactly. So is Deckard a replicant? That's not still not answered, really. I mean, even though Ridley Scott has come on and said it, I don't think it's been answered. I really don't. And I know we could probably spend the next 60 minutes debating that and looking for connections. And frankly, I'm not even sure that Kay's the replicant. I'm not utterly convinced.
I actually am with you on that, David. I think there's going to be a reveal on that at some point. I had that same thing. Even though that's the way they took you in the story, I said, no, there's something else going on there. Or is it possible that replicants can actually then become human? In other words, is there actually a true metamorphosis that can happen through the choice, through the acting out, the kinds of things that only humans can do?
Then they really would be more human than human.
So ultimately, is that what's happening? They're being born again, in the best sense of that word.
So are you saying that life found a way?
He can't resist the Jurassic Park, dude. He's trying to prove that you can find something in any film. And you know, David, you and I do that a lot. We have this amazing capacity to still distill something out of even some much lesser quality film than this one.
Isn't it appropriate to say, when the Pirates of the Caribbean breaks down, the pirates don't eat the tourists?
You really do like Jurassic Park.
I know. I'm taking it one step too far.
I thought you were going to get into chaos theory, and I thought maybe you'll introduce the just because we can. We got to ask, should we? Right?
Should we?
All those great.
I've got so many lines from the film that I loved, but my faves was when Kay is going to find out a little bit more information. He's got, I guess it's Rachel's hair, and he's going to get the DNA. That whole sequence at, I guess it's Wallace's Corporation. I can't remember the name of the company, but they're down in the vaults. And I love the whole darkness thing, the 10 days of darkness, and how the only thing that survived was paper. I mean, how beautiful is that?
Yeah, exactly.
But her line, Love's line, another prodigal serial number returns. Mm-hmm. It's just so great.
You know what impressed me too, and I know we talked a little bit about the set design already, several times actually, but one of the things that impressed me is that the first film is entirely in shadow. This was one is in blazing light, but it feels like it's in shadow. He's walking into a bright orange area, and you can't see past the edge of your arm. There's a mystery the entire film, but it doesn't look exactly like the original the entire time. It's remarkable.
Good observation. That is excellent. Yeah, because the lighting is so spectacular in the first film. This one was just so much. I mean, there was times of darkness, and obviously, the whole where Wallace, lives in kind of his, whatever his creative room, his office, his space there. It had the shimmering sort of almost light coming through water in the early scenes, but then he's sort of in that quasi dark world, and the guy's living blind, dark, and can only see through these light and blindness and eye. I mean, if this isn't a movie that's got spiritual themes, I don't know what does.
Yeah. Guys, this is an incredible conversation. Like you said, we could talk about this for hours. I really think that this is a well-made film. We should do Screen It or Skip It. Screen it or skip it. So
screen it on steroids.
David, screen it or skip it.
Is it that hard to tell?
Yeah, I guess that's fair. It's fair.
I would say screen it and then screen it again.
Yes.
And then again.
Yes. Minimum three.
So screen it cubed. Or sorry, I just showed you that I didn't study mathematics. Because screen it cubed would be what? See it nine times?
Power of three.
There you go. Power of
27. Screen it 27 times.
That's right. Well, I think this is the kind. I truly think this is the kind of film that will reward over time, and I hope you're right in the same way. I mean, clearly, critically, a huge success. I think it's doing okay, and I don't think the investors are going to be brokenhearted time it's released in all its markets and so on, and hopefully wins a few awards. But I truly, I mean, maybe in 20 years we can come back and have another conversation. I hope it's got that kind of staying power. And it certainly seems like it will have.
It's rare that I would say a film does, but it's tied to such a legacy of an original, and it actually feels so important to that original story that I really do think this film will be around for a long time, where people are pored over it and discussing it. It's remarkable filmmaking. So it's obviously it's a screen for
anyone who's already seen that. It's no Jurassic Park, though.
Well, and to be fair, we're talking about that film 25 years later as well. So, I mean, you know.
I'm just teasing.
Perhaps I could offer this as how I see it. It's like, you know, if you had a really great year for grapes, and apparently this has been really good in the Niagara vineyards, this is a vintage that's just going to absolutely age. It's going to age brilliantly. It's going to be such an exquisite bottle to open, you know, at the right time down the road. This is not something which is going to quickly, you know, pass its life and be vinegar, you know, on the shelf in 5 years. This is definitely going to be one of the finest wines to decant and to enjoy for years to come.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you both. Guys, this is just what a fabulous conversation to have you both on. Thank you so much for this. David, can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing right now as well?
Just from a podcasting perspective, I am still very much online, face-to-face-live.ca. Still, believe it or not, coming out of the Toronto International Film Festival. I know, Steve, you were down there for a couple of days. We tried to connect, but it never happened.
We kept missing each other.
Yeah, I just published my 334th podcast with Boris Ivanov and his new film called On Putin's Blacklist, and it's quite a controversial piece. But I've got about four or five more TIFF films. I've got Amanda Lang coming up. I interviewed her recently about her book, The Beauty of Discomfort, and it's just such a pleasure. I feel so blessed to be able to access these guests and to be sort of stepping into the lives of these filmmakers and these storytellers who I think are, for the most part, knocking it out of the park. And so check it out, face-to-facelive.ca. And please, leave an iTunes review, or better yet, head out to Patreon and see what you can do there.
I want to be like David Peck.
How's that T-shirt selling for you, by the way? The franchise rights alone will make you rich beyond your wildest dreams.
The podcaster's mantra.
That's right. Because we both know there's so much money in podcasts.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
There's only 250,000 of them to choose from on iTunes. And that's actually a fact, believe it or not. Oh, that's a gosh. Stat.
But there's only one that's worth listening to, and that's Face to Face. And
face-to-face-live.ca.
And Screenfish. Yeah, you should listen to ours as well.
That's right. A little self-promotion there, Steve. Yeah,
I'm new at this. Michael, what about you? You're involved with something that's pretty exciting coming up as well.
Yeah, one of the things that we do with our initiative called the Infusion Network is we try to provide an infusion of kind of fresh ideas, people who think a little bigger, more broadly, kind of expanding paradigms and vision. And for those of us who come from a faith perspective, and particularly who find something less than maybe what we are looking for in traditional sort of religion and particularly out of the evangelical sort of stream, although there's lots to be grateful for. Some of us have been tracking with those who have been articulating a much more remarkable and I think befitting understanding of the gospel, understanding of the nature of God. And so we've got this great guy named Brad Jurczak coming in. He's from Abbotsford, BC. He'll be in Mississauga Friday, November the 17th evening, and Saturday, November 18th. A time, an evening, and a day to reimagine a God who we would say Jesus unwrapped from dead religion, a love that is always toward us, and a grace that pours into the suffering world through willing human partners. And so Brad's going to be one of he's going to be the key guy to facilitate that weekend. He's an amazing guy who's lived this on the ground. He's done everything from plant a church among marginalized street people and drug addicts, and just done some fantastic stuff on a whole bunch of fronts. And so we're delighted to have him with us in Meadowvale at Meadowvale Community Church in Mississauga, November 17th and 18th. So that's our most recent initiative, and anyone's welcome to be part of that. Cost is fairly nominal, and if you want more information, I'll give you some follow-up links that you can pass along to them.
Great. Great. Sounds good. Guys, honestly, thank you. Of course, for our podcast, you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Podomatic, and SoundCloud. And if you go to our website, screenfish.net, and go to the podcast page for this episode, you'll find Fishing for More, which is some questions that that you can have with the people that you see the film with and have it on your own. This podcast is not just about us talking. We want you to be able to have the conversations as well on your own where you are as well. We will be back in 2 weeks and get back to our regular schedule. Our plan is that in 2 weeks we'll be back with Thor Ragnarok. We also have a couple of fun interviews coming up. Look for our one-on-one with Terrell Carter from the show Empire. And also look for our one-on-one with director Simon Curtis. Simon is the director of Goodbye, Christopher Robin. But guys, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a great time and a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Steve.
Steve, appreciate it.
Anytime. And for you at home, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish. What I thought was so interesting. Just a second, I'm going to sneeze. I think I am. I don't know if I'm going to sneeze or not.
Yeah. Do replicants sneeze?
I don't know.
Do replicants get like the common cold? Can they catch the common cold?
I don't know.
Well, Steve is sneezing, David. Can I just pick up on something?